So, our final keynote of this day is from Derek Jensen, who, thank you, one of my closest friends. His work has changed my life in the last 10 years. And I am extremely proud and honored to be in his circle. He has written more than 20 books, and none of them are small. I think if anyone's read his books, you know that. So please give a very warm welcome to Derek Jensen.
Thanks so much. You know, they have some really comfortable chairs back there. I was thinking about bringing one of them out and sitting in it in case the talk was really boring. I can just go to sleep. I love Thomas Lindsay. I just told him this. I think he does fabulous work. I think he's great. But there's something that I just can't stand about him, which is he is fucking impossible to follow. So thank you, Thomas. Before I start my talk, I want to mention actually one example. Are you around, Thomas? Oh, there you go. I wanted to mention an example. I don't know if you've heard about this. There's an example also of participatory democracy happening up in Del Norte County, where I live. And I'm sure living in California, we know about Prop 215. What? I forgot about it. That was a joke. Jesus Christ, I'm in trouble. Anyway, Prop 215, medical marijuana, and the counties get to determine how many plants you can have. And Del Norte made it so you could have 99 plants per person. And there were those who thought that was excessive. And they wanted to reduce the number to 6, and the county commissioners get to do that. And it was actually a glorious example of participatory democracy in action that night, because the night they wanted to reduce it from 99 to 6, the county commissioner's building was packed. And had they reduced it from 99 to 6, they would have been killed. And this is partly how democracy is supposed to work. Unfortunately, the next week when they were going to do something that was going to harm the salmon, it was the same four people showed up who always show up at the meetings. And what I wish is that people love salmon the way they love marijuana. So I think I want to start by actually asking some questions and just, raise your hands. How many people in the audience think this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Okay, one person raised his hand and then went like this. So we have one person, two people. How many people think this culture is insane? This is a fairly friendly audience. How many people think the culture is sociopathological? We have a really easy panel tomorrow. How many people think, and for this one, I'm going to list a bunch of things, and if you think that this culture hates one, then put your hand up, and then even if you don't think it hates the others, keep your hand up. I'm very interested. How many people think that this culture hates women? Hates people of color? Hates the natural world? Teaches us to hate our bodies? Okay. How many people think this culture has a death urge? Okay, so what I find really interesting is I basically had a 40 and a half page talk trying to convince people of all these things. So basically, at this point, so thank you very much. Good night. Actually, I think now that we understand this, we should do what everybody else in the culture who also understands this in their bodies does, which is we should partay. I'll tell you another thing that breaks my heart, by the way, which is that, I think this is actually a pretty good crowd for people talking seriously about serious issues. But the thing that breaks my heart is that how many people will attend the next 49ers game? You know, I love sports, but it breaks my heart that more people care about the Detroit Tigers than care about real Tigers. And it breaks my heart that since 1975, I believe, or maybe 77, every single University of Michigan Wolverines football game, home football game, has been sold out at 100,000 people. The Michigan Wolverines. And there was a Wolverine in Michigan in 2002, and it was the first one in 200 years. And that breaks my heart. So basically what I want to do then is, since I prepared the talk, I'm going to give it anyway, what the fuck. get rid of that page. Okay, so what I want to talk about actually is why. One of the central questions of my work has always been, why aren't we fighting back? And that's what I really am going to talk about. And sort of as giving the plot away, one of the things I'm going to try to discuss this evening is that I think that the entire culture is suffering from what Judith Herman called complex post-traumatic stress disorder and is suffering from the learned helplessness that often comes to traumatize people. So once again, I've done the whole talk, so thank you very much. Good night. Anyway, the British psychiatrist R.D. Lang wrote, "At this moment in history, we're all caught in the hell of frenetic passivity. We find ourselves threatened by extermination that no one wishes, that everyone fears, that may just happen to us because no one knows how to stop it. There is one possibility of doing so if we can understand the structure of this alienation of ourselves from our experience from our deeds from human authorship. Everyone's carrying out orders. Where do they come from? Always from elsewhere. Is it still possible to reconstitute our destiny out of this hellish and inhuman fatality?" And that's really the question. So when you think of Iraq, is the first thing that you think of cedar forests so thick that the sunlight never touched the ground? That's what it was like before the beginnings of this culture. The first written myth of the dominant culture is Gilgamesh murdering the forest defender and then murdering the forests, deforesting the plains and hillsides of what's now Iraq. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The forests of North Africa fell to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. There were whales in the Mediterranean. There were so many whales in the North Atlantic that they were a hazard to shipping, so many whales that their breath looked like fog. It was said that a squirrel could have leapt from tree to tree from the Atlantic to the Mississippi without ever touching the ground, or from Maine to Texas. The Great Plains were home to the greatest herds of ruminants the world's ever seen. If you were near a river in California, you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. Of course, there still are grizzlies in California, in the zoos and on the flags. Here, the hills were covered with trees and the meadows with shoulder-high grasses. A French sea captain wrote, "There's not any country in the world which more abounds in fish and game of every description. Flocks of geese, ducks, and seabirds were so enormous that when alarmed they rose, quote, in a dense cloud with a noise like that of a hurricane. Huge herds of elk grazed the grasslands. Sea lions blackened the rocks and were so thick it seemed, quote, the entire water, end quote, was covered with a, quote, pavement of sea lions. Whales. Down in Monterey Bay, a European wrote, "It is impossible to conceive of the number of whales with which we were surrounded, or their familiarity. They every half minute spouted within half a pistol shot of the ships and made a prodigious stench in the air. Because there were so many whales, beached whales were extremely common and a source of food for everyone. Troops," that's a quote, "troops of grizzly bears would be feeding on the whales. Troops. Now there's not a single one. The animals weren't afraid of humans because the humans who lived here didn't slaughter them wholesale. Foxes were underfoot." Wouldn't you love to live with foxes underfoot? "Coyotes routinely came into people's homes, quote, appropriating whatever happens to suit. Quail were, quote, so tame that they would often not start from a stone directed at them. Rabbits, quote, can sometimes be caught with a hand. Geese, according to another visitor, were, quote, so impudent that they can scarcely be frightened away by firing upon them." That's how the world was. It's all gone. 200 species were driven extinct today by the dominant culture. They were my brothers and sisters. And it's not only non-humans. Indigenous languages are being exterminated at an even faster relative rate than a non-human species. The genocide is ongoing. In fact, it's accelerating. There were at least between 10,000 and 30,000 people living in this region prior to conquest. The culture tried to wipe them off the earth to a minimum of a few hundred around the start of the 20th century. Stolid scientists are saying that within 35 years, the oceans could be devoid of fish. Already, oysters and other shellfish are experiencing, quote, reproductive failure, end quote, which is science speak for the fact that their babies are dying, each and every one. The response by the dominant culture to the melting of the Arctic ice cap has not been one of horror. It has not been one of deep shame. It has not been an absolute determination to do what is right, to rectify the horrors it's created and is creating. It has been lust. Lust for the resources it can exploit. The dominant culture is killing the planet. Unless we stop it, it will kill every living thing. Unless we stop it. The culture is sociopathological. It has a death urge, an urge to destroy life. Why is this culture so destructive, and how do we stop it? I've spent 20-some books trying to answer those questions. And so far as the former, here's a spoiler alert. I have no idea. Yeah. No matter what answer we come up with, it's insufficient to explain murdering the planet you live on. I don't care how sociopathological you are. That's fucking nuts. It's insufficient to explain rape. It's insufficient to explain so much of what we see around us. In any case, what I want to do with the rest of the talk is explore some possible contributions to the culture's destructiveness. And my understanding, or my belief, is that understanding the problem will help us determine appropriate responses. It's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. If you've incorrectly diagnosed the illness, it doesn't matter how assiduously you follow the cure. It cannot, except by coincidence, cure the illness. That's true on a larger scale, too. Right now, a lot of people are calling to keep the culture more or less the same, but use industrially generated wind and solar electricity to power the economy. Is now the time to mention what happens to birds who fly over solar collectors in the desert? Their wings catch on fire and burn off. Setting aside the practical impossibility of powering the industrial economy using solar and wind, and ignoring the horrible costs of doing so, such as the 18-square-mile open-pit mine in Baotou, China, it ignores, which Baotou, the name means the place where deer run, and evidently they named it before they started mining for rare earths there. It ignores the fact that burning oil isn't the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. The culture was killing the planet long before it started burning oil. Oil facilitates and escalates it. I'm not saying the oil economy doesn't have to go. I'm saying it's a symptom. And I'm all for treating symptoms, except when we pretend that treating one symptom cures a disease. It often doesn't. In this case, as Darge Mayo said earlier, wildlife has decreased by more than 50% in the last 40 years. That's true from the tiniest arthropods to the largest fish. Nearly all that loss is not because of global warming, which is only now starting to kick in hard. So we need to go deeper. So far as the latter question, how do we stop it? I think that's actually pretty straightforward. If space aliens came down from outer space and they were vacuuming the oceans, changing the climate, putting docks in every mother's breast milk. If they were, I just read this yesterday, the lakes in Canada are turning to jelly. And this is because of the calcium. I don't remember why it is. But anyway, I just read this yesterday that the lakes, and I read it in the newspaper, so it must be true. And what? Okay, acid rain is turning the lakes into jelly. And so if space aliens were doing this, if they were causing all these changes, if they were changing our endocrine systems, by the way, you know, you'd think that if there was one thing that could get people, especially if that could get people to stop this culture, it would be when your endocrine systems are messed up and you are losing the ability to have sex. It's like, that's not stopping us. So I mean this literally. It's like, what the fuck is it going to take? What the non-fuck is it going to take? In any case, if they were space aliens doing this, we would know what to do, and we would do it. But because it's members of the dominant culture who are doing the culture into which nearly all of us have been enculturated, and never forget that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture, suddenly we get really stupid. And we think that the way to stop the destroyers is by recycling or taking shorter showers. Or, and here's the point, by controlling the things that we can control as we assiduously ignore the destroyers who are destroying. Or we might at best appeal to the space aliens to please have the right permits in place before they kill us off. I recently saw a headline that in many states in the United States, the people are facing the choice, not the people, but the states are facing a choice between drinking water and fracking. The newspaper article said this was a, quote, dilemma. Indeed. The article also said that scientists are mixed in their recommendations as to how to solve this dilemma. So the question becomes, why do we not resist commensurate with the problems we face? We are, after all, talking about the murder of the planet. Oh, and by the way, I don't think anybody in this audience will, but I want to say this anyway. Don't quibble with the word murder. Some people, I'll say, you know, the planet's being murdered, and people will say, oh, come on, the planet isn't being murdered. It's like I saw this article about the oceans being killed, but the scientist did not say the oceans are being killed. He said they're being, quote, reorganized. And, you know, they always say, you can't kill the planet. There'll still be some bacteria left. But whenever somebody says that to me, I always ask them if I can borrow a knife. You see where this is going. And then I ask them to hold out their hands. I tell them not to worry. I'm not going to kill them. I'm just going to reorganize them. And, of course, I'm not going to do any of this. So what I say is I'll just cut off your hands. I'm going to cut off your feet and then your arms and your legs. But I'm not going to kill you, for God's sake. I mean, even when your heart stops beating, bacteria will still be alive. So quit worrying. And, of course, once again, I'm not even going to stab anybody. That's not the point. The point is we come up with 10,000 reasons not to resist and 10,000 ways to underestimate the harm that we're causing. So before we talk about some of the reasons this culture is destructive, I want to set aside two reasons that are often given. The first is greed. You know, people always say that. People like on the street, if like on a plane or something, I'll say, you know, I'm going to talk about why this culture is killing the planet, and I'll always say, that's greed. End of story. Sure, greed's part of the problem, but when the planet is being murdered, the problem goes way beyond simple greed. And besides, greed in no way accounts for a lot of the other atrocities that are caused by the same mindset. Greed doesn't account, for example, for rape. Sure, I understand that rape is an act of political terror, and as a whole, acts as a way to terrorize women into submission as a category of people. But that still doesn't explain it. There's an urge to violate, an urge to dominate, an urge to exterminate, to obliterate, that goes way beyond greed. And hell, if you recall the descriptions of San Francisco that I gave, the Ohlone people had it pretty easy in terms of gathering food. Would you rather have to work for some big corporation so you can pay rent and buy food, or would you rather step outside your dwelling and then have to shoo away the rest of the geese so you can catch one of them for dinner? It's like, from a perspective of self-interest, the Ohlone had a much better way of life. The other common notion that's thrown out all the time is that humans are inherently destructive. And I've even heard a fair number of people say that intelligence is, quote, a lethal mutation. I'm not sure members of the dominant culture are intelligent. We'll leave that aside. Of course, that's bullshit. The Talawa lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived there since the beginning of time. And when the Europeans arrived, it was a paradise. Likewise, humans have lived in this region for at least 6,000 years or since the beginning of time. They didn't trash the place. And the reason they didn't trash the place is not because they were too stupid to invent backhoes. Those who say that humans are inherently destructive have to either ignore the existent examples of indigenous people, which is what they usually do, or they have to pretend indigenous peoples cause just as much harm as the dominant culture does, which some people like Charles Mann do, or they have to pretend that indigenous peoples didn't do the damage merely because they evidently weren't quite clever enough to invent devices of mass destruction. And there's this very strange and harmful conflation of destruction with intelligence in this culture. Excuse me. I just saw an interview with that asshole, Elon Musk, in which he talked about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He said that one sign to look for is atmospheric pollution. Seriously, pollution is a sign of intelligence. Frankly, I'm still searching for signs of intelligence within the dominant culture. In any case, never once do members of the dominant culture acknowledge that perhaps indigenous peoples don't destroy their land base because these others aren't insane. But what I'm really getting at is that some humans have lived sustainably, which means it isn't inherent to humans to act like we do. Also, there have been cultures who didn't rape or perpetrate child abuse. If one culture can do it, then it's not biologically determined. To say that the problem is human nature is a cop-out, and it's a lie. It's an excuse to not ask hard questions. Worse, it does what oppressors always try to do, which is to naturalize or make seem natural or inevitable their oppressiveness, their own behavior that's the result of personal and social choices. If you can convince people that this is the natural order of things, you've won. You'd think with all the world at stake, we would not settle for a cop-out and a lie. But we spend more time forcing ourselves to not notice what's going on than we do asking why or trying to stop it. Part of the reason, I think it's really helpful to look at the dominant culture with the same sort of dynamic as an abusive family. And R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this meant within my own family structure, which was very abusive, is that we could talk about anything we wanted in the entire world except for my father's violence, which we had to pretend wasn't happening. And on a larger social structure, larger social scale, we can talk about anything we want except for the corporations that are killing the planet, except for the culture that's killing the planet. We can't talk about those key issues. And I guess part of what I was trying to say earlier about greed not being all of it is that it's long been really clear to me, even as a kid, that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational or reasonable and are not therefore amenable to rational solution. You know, people come up with all sorts of clever ideas, but clever ideas don't by themselves work because the problem is fundamentally one of insanity. Beyond having your basic creature comforts met, greed doesn't make any sense. Likewise, abuse doesn't make any sense. What the fuck sense does it make to rape one's daughter or anyone? Or pesticides. You know, I've been asking forever, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Or think about this in terms of fracking or anything else. Who's the idiot who came up with the idea of poisoning our own drinking water? Of course, all of these can be made to make sense. Basically, everybody who commits an atrocity has a claim to virtue and has their beliefs and their actions fully rationalized. The Nazis weren't committing genocide, they were purifying the Aryan race. The Americans weren't and aren't committing genocide, they're manifesting their destiny. The capitalists aren't killing the planet, they're developing natural resources. And if Hitler, it was said, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So they have it rationalized. So what? It's still all insane. You know, this is the same thing is true on a personal level. I don't know about you, but I have never once in my life been a jerk. Never once. Every time that I was objectively a jerk, I had it fully rationalized. And I would never have done it if it wouldn't have been for A, B, and C, which makes perfect sense to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. But objectively, I was a jerk. So the fact that the problems aren't fundamentally rational is hugely important because you couldn't have talked Hitler out of his madness or Ted Bundy, and it didn't take a lot of smarts to figure out that putting in dams kills rivers, which hasn't stopped this culture from obsessively damming, re-killing essentially every river on the planet. And just yesterday, I read an article about the current boom in big dams, and no, it was not the sort of boom that I think most of us would be interested in. Or we don't have to talk about Hitler or Bundy. We can talk about garden variety abusers. How many of you have ever known an abuser? We should form a club. So the question is, were the abusers reasonable? Sure, they could make their own internal shit make sense, and they could gaslight you, but were they fundamentally reasonable? And there's something I call the abuse model or abuse game that helps me understand how abusers work. The game's really simple. It's kind of fun, too. One person plays a regular person, and the other person plays an abuser. And the regular person says a sentence, and then the abuser then uses that sentence to try to pick a fight. And the goal of the game is for the regular person to come up with any sentence that the abuser cannot use to pick a fight. It's very, very hard. So the regular person says, "It's a nice day." The other person, "Oh, Jesus, it's easy for you to say after the day I had. Jesus Christ, there you go again. You think I have it easy? You're so narcissistic, I can't even believe it. You think that just because you have a nice day, everybody else must have had a nice day. For God's sake, why don't you ever think about me?" Or, "You're really smart. Oh, so basically you think I'm only up here. I'm too much in my head, Mr. Fucking Egghead. Too analytical. No empathy. You think I got no empathy? I will show you some empathy right now. I was doing this with a friend one time, and the friend said, okay, I got one. You're perfect. Shit. Well, I can't do anything with that. I was thinking about it for a little while, and then I got it. It's like, oh, my God. You know how hard it is to be put on a pedestal? You know, it's so much pressure. I cannot believe that you would do that to me. I cannot believe how you hurt me like that. Why don't you ever think about me for once? The point of the abuse game is to help us recognize the patterns and to help us recognize that the ostensible subject is not the point. The point is to pick a fight. The point on the larger scale is to not get lost in rhetoric, but pay attention to what people actually do. The point is not the rationalization. The point is not the stated reason. It's never the stated reason. It's what my horoscope for today, somebody sent this to me. My horoscope for today is that don't pay attention to what people say, pay attention to what they do, which is pretty cool because I'd already written the talk. And that's the whole point of the talk. For God's sake, I just read this the other day. This was in, I got to show off. I actually read, this is so cool. I read Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Aren't I cool? Anyway, he has a line in there where Timur the Great, Tamerlane, he actually said, he caused wars that killed 5% of the world's population. He actually said that every bit of his conquering was purely defensive. The KKK, of course, claims it is not a hate group, but a love group, because it loves whites. Timber corporations and politicians have come up with dozens of excuses for deforestation. Oh, there's the most recent one I heard the other day is that because of the drought in California, the reservoirs are low, and when it rains, if you have a forest, the forest acts like a sponge and soaks up the water, and that water does not end up in the reservoirs, which means that because the reservoirs are low, what you have to do is cut the rest of the forest so that the water will run off, including the sediment, presumably. Yeah, this is real. This is their latest argument. The point is, the urge to destroy is the point. Somebody or another said, by their fruits ye shall know them. This guy became kind of famous. Then he went on tour. When 99, the tour was cut short, though, somewhere in the Near East. When I had an unfortunate end. When 99% of the native forests are gone, what's the pattern? What's really going on? So the question is, how did I realize, this is what I was thinking about this for when I was doing this talk, is how did I realize that the culture has a death urge? And it's really simple. You look around, and you see 99% of the forests are gone. You see that everybody's going. And the commercial fishing fleets around the world are subsidized at a value greater than the value of their catch. The governments of the world pay fishing fleets around the world more in subsidies than they actually get in their catch. We would all be better off if they simply paid the people to stay at home and sit in their underpants and watch The Price is Right. Oh, it's like they're cutting down the Tongass forest. There's a timber sale they just put out that the subsidy is, I believe, $100,000 per logger. And their argument, by the way, for having to put out this new timber sale is that they've cut so much of the timber already that the sawmills are empty, and so they need to cut more because the loggers are going to run out of a job because they already overcut the forest. Okay, I'm not saying don't educate, and I'm not saying not to use discourse. I'm a writer, for crying out loud. I'm just saying that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis, and sometimes the talking cure works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes abusers just have to be stopped. So in a language older than words, I describe the entire culture as suffering from complex PTSD. And PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder, is when you have been traumatized. If you've been traumatized, you may later on experience flashbacks when you get reminders of it. So, for example, if a woman was raped in a certain make and model of car, then whenever she sees that make and model of car, she may have fear associated with that. Or, you know, the cliche is of the combat veterans who, if they hear a car backfire, they jump. Or my mom was in a terrible, terrible car wreck, and it was on a dark and rainy night. And so when she's a passenger in a car on a dark and rainy night, she is very tense. We're all fairly familiar with this. And then Judith Herman talked about something called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, she asked, what happens if people are not traumatized once, but they are held captive? What happens if they are prisoners or if they are raised in captivity, as in victims of domestic violence, survivors of domestic violence? What happens? There are other things that happen to you beyond the more simple post-PTSD. I'll get to some of the symptoms in a minute. But before I talk about those symptoms, I want to talk about some of the symptoms of this culture. Excuse me. So many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the land as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. Another way to say that is that Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings with whom we can enter into relationship, other beings whose lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me, other beings who are every bit as alive and sentient as are you or I. And that, of course, includes not only other animals, but plants and rivers and mountains and forests. And, of course, how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. If when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when you look at women, you see orifices, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at women, you see women, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular woman, you see this particular woman, you'll treat her differently still. And one of the fundamental flaws of this culture, I think, is the perception that the individual is the fundamental unit of nature, or the fundamental unit of evolution, or even worse, that the gene is the fundamental unit of evolution. I think we are ourselves, of course, and we're also parts of a larger whole. Likewise, a tree is itself, and it is part of a larger being. A forest is a living being. A river is a living being. Now, before you laugh and say a river is just a container through which water flows and happens to be filled with other beings, let me ask you, when was the last time you had a drink of water? And let me ask you, when's the next time you're going to pee? Let me remind you that water is flowing through you. And let me ask you, what percentage of you is water? And let me remind you that more than 90% of the cells in your body don't contain your DNA. And let me remind you also that the bacteria in your body are going to outlive you. Some of them are just waiting for you to die to start eating you. You could easily be considered a container through which water and nutrients pass, just like a river, and you are habitat for lots of other creatures, just like a river, which doesn't mean that you aren't yourself. Part of our problem is that we perceive bodies and forests and rivers and mountains as though they were human-created artifacts. There's nothing to a chair except its parts. I can take apart a chair, replace the screws, let it sit on my floor for 3 months, and then put it back together, and I still have a chair. You can't do that with a body. Someone can't take apart your body bit by bit, put it all back together, and still have you. The same is true for a forest. You can't take a redwood forest, remove the salmon and the grizzlies, and expect the forest to be the same. Of course, you can survive without a lung, and evidently most human supremacists can survive without using their brains, but you are more than the sum of your parts, as is every other living being, which means as is everyone. And while we're talking about this, I'd like to debunk the harmful notion that evolution is based strictly on competition. I know we've all been taught that it's based on survival of the fittest, which is supposed to mean survival of the meanest, most exploited, most capitalistic. That's just a projection of the dominant mindset onto the natural world, as we'll see, the result of a traumatized psyche. It's an attempt to naturalize this culture's awful and exploited behavior. See, everybody exploits. We're just really good at it. We're number one. I can debunk this in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons. Those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. It's not survival of the fittest. It's survival of the fit, meaning how well you fit into your natural surroundings, how much you make the world a better place by your existence. Is the world a better place because you were born? Not the culture, the world. Oh, this guy wrote to me the other day and said, who cares if salmon go extinct? And I wrote back and said, well, first off, forests care. Second off, I care. And the real question is, who cares if you die? I mean, I don't think he was applauding. I mean, how do you think that the world became so wild and fecund and beautiful and full of life in the first place? It was by everybody living and dying. That's how it becomes better, is everybody improves the world by their lives. That's how the world has to work. And it's a measure of our collective stupor that we don't all know this. You know, scientists also love to talk about the way, one of the ways we learn things is by creating a model and then seeing how the application, that model, affects the experimental subjects. So I can hypothesize, and if it doesn't affect them the way you think, then your model is probably wrong. So I can have a hypothesis that humans can survive on Lucky Charms. So then I feed someone Lucky Charms and Lucky Charms alone, and if this person gets sick, I presume that my model is incorrect. Okay? But here's the deal. The dominant culture has been acting on the notion that natural selection is based on hyper-exploitation, and it ain't working. The entire world's being murdered. If they were space aliens who were conducting this experiment, we would all see them as completely insane. But once again, because we've been inculcated into this culture, because we too have been made insane by the culture, we can't see it. I want to mention one more thing before I move on, which is the great chain of being, which is really fundamental to this culture. It's the notion that all life is hierarchical. God's at the top, and then angels, and then the king, and then regular dudes, and then women, and then, quote, primitives, who are halfway between humans and animals, and then animals, then plants, then rocks, soil, and so on. Obviously, this hierarchy was developed by kings and their allies. Which, by the way, have you ever noticed how when somebody develops one of these hierarchies, they always end up at the top? It's an amazing, amazing coincidence. Oh, it's like the whole thing. You know, I just love this, the nomenclature. Humans are called Homo sapiens sapiens. It's like, for the longest time, I thought they just added the second sapiens to make sure we got the joke. You know, what sapiens means wisest of the wise, Homo sapiens sapiens. I guess I should have told you that first. What sort of egomaniac would label themselves that? It's like, I'm going to create a new system of nomenclature. It's Derek sapiens sapiens. Thank you very much. So here's the deal. Even though we don't generally believe in the divine right of kings anymore, the great chain of being still pervades our thinking. So many of us think that humans are the pinnacle of evolution, or think that animals are more sentient than plants and so on. Basically, somebody else's sentience and beingness is determined by how closely it resembles ours, which is really narcissistic. And frankly, the divine right of kings hasn't gone away anyway. It's become the divine right of humans, or rather, the divine right of humans in dominant culture. Just like the king was appointed by God to be able to take whatever he wanted and fuck whomever he wanted, humans now consider themselves to have been appointed by evolution as being able to take whatever they want and fuck over whomever they want. Why else would it be even considered even remotely okay to kill the oceans, or for that matter, San Francisco Bay? So what does this have to do with complex PTSD? So years ago, I asked trauma expert Judith Herman about the symptoms. She said, quote, "In the aftermath of trauma, people see danger everywhere. This seems to be a biological phenomenon, not just a psychological one." She's just described this culture. Indigenous peoples tend to see the world as their home, their provider, as opposed to this culture that tries to get us to believe that nature is red in tooth and claw, that all creatures ought to get us, so we've got to get them first. By the way, I'm also just curious, how many people in here hate the animal planet? Oh, for God's sake, there's only like five of us? Sorry, oh, the animal planet's great. It's a wonderful show. It's wonderful. No, it's just terrible. It's like supposed to be about nature programs, but they're all these horrible programs. Like, have you ever noticed that whenever you see a carnivores, like if there's a lion on a nature program, the lion is going to be killing a gazelle. Always. You know, lions will have sex like 20 times a day. And unless you're watching David Attenborough, you don't learn about the sex habits of non-human animals, in which case David Attenborough is very excited. Or like spiders. You know, if you see a spider, it's eating a fly. A lot of species of spiders eat like once a year. I mean, they spend all their time just thinking spider thoughts. So anyway, another group of symptoms has to do with a shutting down of feelings, a constriction of emotions, intellect, and behavior. So constriction of intellect, that's how people can put poisons on their own food. You know, it's not very smart. They kill every river. You know, we learn the ability to, the capacity to think. Constriction of emotions, that's how people can vivisect. They can have factory farms. That's how people can rape. Know that all of those are about control. She also said that people can oscillate between feeling overwhelmed, enraged, terrified, desperate, or in extreme grief and pain, and feeling nothing at all. They can oscillate between feeling overwhelmed, enraged, terrified, desperate, in extreme grief and pain, or feeling nothing at all. There you go. I mean, that's most of our response to the murder of the planet. I mean, for that matter, that's most of our response to our jobs. And now we start to get the real point. Judith Herman said, because people in captivity are most often isolated from other relationships, They're forced to depend for basic survival on the very person who's abusing them. This is classic to abusive relationships. And about being cut off from other relationships, how much more cut off can you be than to be cut off from the source of all life? You know, ask yourself, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? Car, clock, computer. How many wild plants or animals do you have a daily relationship with? Remember, you see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes here. Like right now, how many machines are within, you know, 20 feet of us? How many wild animals are within 100 yards of us? We often think of cities as places of sensory overload. At least I do. On tour, I go to my hotel room and I pull the drapes shut and I don't go out except to eat because it's all just too painful for me. I feel abraded at the end of the day. But there's a deeper way that it's a place of sensory deprivation. How much of your sensory perceptions originate in or are mediated by human beings, or worse, by machine creations? How much of our sensory perceptions comes from non-humans? This is not how we evolved. This is not how we're supposed to live. We're listening only to ourselves. And people in echo chambers begin to hallucinate. This is what John Livingston thought was the source of our ideology and our customs, the hallucinations of those suffering sensory deprivation. It certainly makes sense to me. And if all your perceptions originate in or are mediated by humans, you can come to believe that humans are the only things that truly exist, and certainly the only things that speak. The monopolization of perception is really classic to abusive relationships. One of the reasons is if an abuser can cut you off from your other social relations, the abuser can convince you that the abusive way is normal. It wasn't until she was in eighth grade that my sister knew that not all fathers rape their daughters. So if you can get people to believe that this is absolutely normal, there's no reason to fight it. We always have to struggle to remember there are other ways to be. That's one reason that Milan Kundera wrote that, Vaclav Havel, some guy from Eastern Europe, said that the struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And that's one reason that those in the dominant culture must destroy or assimilate every indigenous culture it can. And it's one reason they have to destroy or domesticate wild nature, because people must never know that there is or ever has been any other way to be. That's their best tool for getting people to not resist. As the Catholics used to say, outside the church, there is no salvation. As scientists say, outside science, there is no knowledge. And as so many of us seem to believe, outside civilization, there's no life worth living. Isolating us makes us dependent on them, not only perceptually and socially, but physically. That's true on the level of the individual abuser, and it's true on a larger social scale. From the beginning, those in power have wanted to separate us from the land. It's one of the primary ways they control us. The early cities had walls not around the outside of the city, but around the granaries, because they knew that if the king could control the food supply, he could control the worker supply. It's like John Mohawk always said, there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty. And there was a 1830s Southern pro-slavery philosopher who wrote to his northern abolitionist buddy saying that there are land ownership conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves, and land ownership conditions in which it's the capitalist's best interest to not own slaves. It's very simple. There's a lot of land and not many people. It is in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves, because if there's a lot of land and not many people, people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they will not go to work for you except at the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, that means they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they will have to go to work for you for whatever pittance you want to pay them. And so in that case, as a capitalist, it is not in your interest to own them. And they've known this all along. And so one of the reasons that we don't resist is because our experience is that our food comes from the grocery store and our water comes from the tap, which means we will defend to the death that system, because that's what's keeping us alive. We have been made dependent upon the system, just like any good abuser is going to make you dependent upon them. And if, on the other hand, your experience is that your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend those to the death because your life depends on them. All this is crucial to capitalism. Two more quotes from Herman about complex PTSD. The abuse captivity, quote, creates a complicated bond between the two and skews the victim's perception and nature of human relationships. The situation is even worse for children raised in those circumstances because their personality is formed in the context of an exploitative relationship, which the overarching principles are those of coercion and control, of dominance and subordination. Whether we're talking about adults or children, It often happens that a kind of sadistic corruption enters into the captive's emotional relational life. People lose their sense of faith in themselves and other people. They come to believe or view all relationships as coercive and come to feel that the strong rule, the strong do as they please. They believe that all relationships are contaminated and corrupted, that sadism is the principle that rules all relationships. She's just described this culture. Might makes right, social Darwinism, the selfish gene theory, original sin. That right there describes the principles that undergird the entire political, economic, scientific, and religious systems. That's it. And even more, they reach into our epistemology itself. Epistemology is a study, really, of how we know what's true. Richard Dawkins has stated that, quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and predict what will happen and when. And that's true. When you flip a light switch, the lights go on. That's how we know that science is working, that science really knows how the universe works. But he's done something really sneaky, which is he has conflated domination with how we know something's true. And to think about this, just think about this. Let's pretend that I have a hoop and I have a gun. And I put the hoop right here and I point the gun at you and I say, okay, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop or I'm going to shoot you. So on the count of three, you jump through the hoop. What do you know? I'm a fucking genius. I just predicted what will happen and when, and I just made matter and energy jump through hoops on command. But don't you think it's possible that by doing that, I foreclosed all possibility of friendship? There are other ways to know. And science is one way that is based on control. And our entire epistemology, it doesn't really get more basic than epistemology. And that has been corrupted by the notion of control. Herman continued, there are other losses involved, a loss of basic trust, a loss of feeling of mutuality of relatedness. In its stead is emplaced a feeling of contempt for self and others. That's what we see around us. How much more contempt can you have for another being than to deny that they even have subjective existence at all? And clearly we as a culture feel contempt for the natural world, or we wouldn't destroy it. And clearly we have contempt for ourselves, or we wouldn't put up with any of this shit. We wouldn't put up with dioxin in every mother's breast milk. I mean, that's nuts. We wouldn't put up with corporations having control. We wouldn't put up with any of this stuff. She continues, if you've been punished for showing autonomy, initiative, or independence, after a while you're not going to show them. In the aftermath of that kind of brutalization, victims have a great deal of difficulty taking responsibility for their lives. Often people who try to help get frustrated because we don't understand why the victims seem so passive, seem so unable to extricate themselves to advocate on their own behalf. They seem to behave as though they're still under the perpetrator's control, even though we think they're now free. But in some ways, the perpetrator has been internalized. That's it. That's it exactly. I keep asking why we don't fight back. The world's being murdered, and for the most part, we aren't doing shit. And of course, those being abused or held captive have to learn to identify with their oppressors. They have to. They have to care deeply how their oppressors are doing, and they have to cater to their captor's whims because an unhappy captor is more likely to harm you. We see this on every scale, from the most personal to the most ecological. Oh, for God's sake, I don't really have time for this, but yesterday I got detained for 45 minutes at the San Francisco airport over something that was completely fucking ridiculous. Oh, they said I was smoking marijuana in the bathroom, which I wasn't. And so they detained me for 45 minutes. And the cop was a prick. I wouldn't have minded if he would have been polite. You know, we had a report, blah, blah, blah. But he was a complete asshole, and I kept saying, I don't have a lighter. I don't have a vaporizer. I don't have anything. I don't have any pot. I don't have anything. He's like, okay, so you destroyed the evidence. He kept saying, so I would not be here if you had not done something wrong. I was like, well, dude, the logic doesn't actually work. But I did not say to him, dude, the logic doesn't actually work, because I knew if I did, I would be face down on the ground with handcuffs on. So the point is that I had a captor. I mean, he was a captor at that moment, so I was reasonably polite and, as they say, compliant. And, you know, it's the same thing happened one time when I was going through TSA years ago. This woman put her hand, this TSA agent, put her hand on my pants. I said, you're putting your hand on my pants. And she said, I'm doing this for your safety. I said, no, this is not actually for my safety. And then she said, would you like for me to call over the police? And I had a choice. I could either make a scene or I could get the hell out of Austin, Texas. And so what I did is I got the hell out of Austin, Texas. I shut up. My point is, it makes a lot of sense when somebody has control over you to be compliant. But then we internalize it. We naturally, that's what happens. And so we end up caring more about the health of the system than we do about the health of our own bodies. And what does every so-called solution to global warming that's presented in the mainstream have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial civilization as a given and the natural world as having to conform to industrial civilization. When did environmentalism stop being about protecting the natural world and start being about, quote, sustainability, which is about sustaining this way of life that's killing the planet? That's fucking outrageous, outsane. It is insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality because the health of the planet must be primary, always. Without a planet, you don't have any social system at all. But that's not how we think, because our every action must be to protect the system. Right after Fukushima, one of the Japanese energy ministers said that they have to keep going with nuclear power because, quote, we can't imagine living without electricity. So I was thinking a few things. One of them is, well, right now about 2 billion people on the planet live without electricity, and they do very fine. Also, humans did fine up until about the turn of the, you know, maybe 1920, before that, without industrially generated electricity. We basically were on 5 continents. And we were doing very well. And you can't imagine them without electricity. But the main thing that hit me is that have you ever heard some public official say, we can't imagine living without polar bears? We can't imagine living without monarch butterflies? We can't imagine living without the Colorado River reaching the ocean? We can't imagine living without living oceans? We can't imagine. That's the problem, is a failure of imagination. That we can't imagine living without Wi-Fi, but we can imagine living without salmon. And have you ever noticed that every fucking news article about some creature being driven extinct always refers back to the economic effects of this extinction? This pisses me off. Quote, ocean acidification due to excessive release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is threatening to produce large-scale changes in the marine ecosystem affecting all levels of the food chain. A scientist warned that ocean acidification also carries serious financial implications. The aquaculture industry is deeply concerned. They're trying to figure out basically how they can avoid going out of business. Headline, revealed how global warming is changing Scotland's marine life. First sentence, global warming could cut commercial fish catches around Scotland by 20%. CBS News headline, saltwater fish extinction seen by 2048. Terrible news for the entire planet, right? Well, we know what's really important. One of the researchers is quoted as saying, if biodiversity continues to decline, the marine environment will not be able to sustain our way of life. So, I say to you, I've heard that every member of your family is dying from poison released by the factory I put in next door. You look pretty sick. I bet you're not going to last another month. And your kids? Oh, my God, that's one of your children. Is she still alive? She looks... This is just awful. It's unbelievable. I'm so sorry that you're all dying, because if you die, who's going to work in my factory? And I'm going to go out of business. That's it. So, one piece of this puzzle is this culture's incredible destructiveness. We're all insane, having been driven so by this horrible culture. We're acting out the symptoms of complex PTSD. Oh, and part of what all this adds up to is a desperate need to control, not only because what we control has less chance to hurt us, but also because anyone or anything who is wild and free will remind us of who and what we were before we ourselves were traumatized, before we ourselves were enslaved. That's too painful. So we have to destroy every reminder of who we were. Instead, we have to control. We have to assert control. We must be the ones who do too, not the ones to whom it is done. And that need to control is killing the planet. Okay, that's all fine, but I don't think that trauma is enough to explain this culture's behavior. It's not good enough to simply act out your issues. Those who are still sane are going to call you on it. What you need to do is to systematize your insanity. Instead of just saying, for example, that men are superior to women, what you need to do is to create a god, male of course, and get him to say it. Then everybody who disagrees with you isn't just disagreeing with you, they're disagreeing with the big guy himself. They're not merely breaking your law, but God's law, and God knows if you've been naughty or nice. It may take a little work, and it may take a few beatings to convince the women that God's on your side, but if the beatings are fierce enough to, as they say, put the fear of God in them, it's going to pay off in the long run. It'll be a lot less work later. It'll make your job of oppression ever so much easier. And the same is true, by the way, with making your God white and human. And while you're at it, go ahead and tell your God to tell you that you should go forth and multiply, that you should have dominion over the earth, that you should conquer everybody who doesn't believe in your God. Then you have a claim to virtue ready-made for everything. And if you keep up that pressure for a few generations, your abusiveness will become codified. And that's really the point, because any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like religion, or it feels like philosophy, or economics, or law, or science, or just the way things are. As the United States Supreme Court said about land theft and genocide, if your entire way of life is based on it, quote, it becomes the law of the land and cannot be questioned. That's Johnson v. McIntyre, I don't remember which. And that's when you've really got them. And I'm going over time, so I'm going to cut all my Ruth Benedict stuff. Basically, the Ruth Benedict stuff, actually, I guess I won't cut it. The Ruth Benedict stuff is she wanted to figure out why some cultures, people are fairly nice, and other cultures, there are a lot of people really surly or nasty, and why women are treated well in some cultures and they're treated poorly in others, why some cultures are very warlike and others are pretty peaceful, why people are generally happy in some cultures, why they're not so happy in others. And it all fell down. This is some really simple rules. And what it is what she found is the good cultures had figured out that humans are both selfish and social. And they got rid of this selfishness, altruism, bifurcation by praising behavior that benefited the group as a whole and by disallowing behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the group. So what this means is that if you do something good for the group, you get praised, which means your most selfish act is to give to the group. And on the other hand, the bad cultures, the cultures that were very warlike, that treated women and children very poorly, were the opposite, where they reinforced behavior, they socially reinforced behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the group, and they did not reinforce behavior that benefited the group. And there are many ways to doing this. There are nations in the Pacific Northwest who had what's called a shaming poll, which is if somebody does something really bad, you put a poll outside their house that basically says, "I'm a jerk." And that's a form of discouraging that behavior. And really what she found is it all came down to how culture handles wealth. That if the culture handles wealth through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, everybody in your community is happy because everybody's secure. Because if I catch salmon and I keep it all to myself or I try to sell it, then they would put a shaming pole outside my house, or somebody would. On the other hand, if I catch it and I give it, then everybody... I gain esteem, which is what we really care about as communal creatures. We want to be accepted and celebrated. And the other cultures, on the other hand, think capitalism, would benefit behavior. They would reward. Like, we all know who Bill Gates is. Why do we know who Bill Gates is? Because he accumulated a lot of money. That's it. And if you have a social... It's very simple. Basically, people do what they get rewarded for. That's it. And what she found is that good cultures reward good behavior and bad cultures reward bad behavior. I don't know why it took an anthropologist to figure that one out. Okay, so there's something else. The next level is we've talked about sociological and psychological reasons. I want to talk about physical reasons, too. I want to talk for just a moment about agriculture. As you know from earlier, basically what agriculture is a way to... Agriculture is the conversion of an entire land base to one use, like the plow agriculture. And one of the things it does for you is it allows you to have your population expand. One of the disadvantages is that it destroys your land base. So once you've committed yourself to this path of having a lot of people on that particular patch of land of overshoot, that means you're either going to have to collapse because you've destroyed your land base, or you're going to have to expand. And the disadvantage of this is that there are other people who are already living on the land next to you. So one of the things this means is once you've committed yourself to that life, you're going to have to be militaristic. You're going to have to keep up this conquest. But one of the advantages of this way of life is if you destroy your land base and turn it into machines of war and into standing armies, you have a competitive advantage over the cultures who don't. And this is a problem that we need to solve, and I don't know that we've ever really faced it. I'm saying this very poorly, but the point is that once you have committed yourself to a way of life based on the drawing down of the land, you not only have committed yourself to a way of life that has no future and a way of life based on conquest, but you have also given yourself a competitive... If you destroy the rivers to make electricity so that you can build tanks, you're going to have an advantage over people who didn't do that. But then you've committed yourself to it. So it really puts those of you who don't actually want to have that lifestyle in a very difficult position that we have yet to be able to figure out how to stop. I'm going to skip down. And oh, thank you. It's not just agriculture. It's the theft of all other resources, too. I'm always kind of surprised by how many sort of anti-empire activists still want the fruits of empire, who seem to think you can have the fruits of empire without having actual empire. But basically, in one form or another, all of our energy and consumer goods comes from empire. I'll talk about that in a second, but I'm sort of muddling here for a second, but I was thinking about this. Last year I did an interview with this guy from Nature Online Journal, and Nature Online is just dreadful, just dreadful. Anyway, one of his questions was this, and this is back to this question of why drop agriculture. I just blew that. Why we're killing the planet. One of his questions to me, this is from Nature Magazine, surely nature can only be appreciated by humans. I like this audience. If nature were to cease to exist, nature itself would not notice. You know, I hope the journalist who asked me this question listens to this. As it is not conscious, and other than through life's drive for homeostasis, is indifferent to its own existence. Nature thus only achieves worth through our consciously valuing it. Okay, at the precise moment he said this to me, I was looking out the window at a mother bear lying on her back in the grass in the sunshine with her two cubs playing on her belly. And I said to him what I was looking at, and I said, do you mean to tell me that she is not enjoying being on the sunshine with her children? And he said, yes, that's what I'm telling you, is that she does not have the capacity to enjoy. And I said, have you ever known any bears personally? And he said, no. And he thought the question was absurd. And that is why the world's being killed. There was another thing he did in the same conversation that was very interesting to me. 10 minutes? Holy fuck. Okay, so I'm going to talk like an auctioneer for the rest of the time. I'll tell you the story real quick. That the guy, he also said this thing. He said that he believes that we should have non-exploitative economic systems, and only all exchanges should be purely voluntary. And so I said, okay, great, that sounds wonderful. And he thinks that that can happen within an industrial system. I said, okay, great, wonderful. In a city, how are you going to get around? He said, buses. I said, okay, great. What are you going to make the buses out of? And he said, metal. I said, okay, great. Where are you going to get the metal? He said, mines. I said, great. How are you going to get people to go in the mines? Because people don't want to go underground and work in mines for the most part, and that's one of the first forms of slavery, really. And he said, you pay them a lot. I said, okay. Do you accept that mines are actually very destructive of the environment and it will destroy, say, the river that is right next to the mine? He said, yes, but that's nature, and nature doesn't care about its own, so nature doesn't count. I said, okay, fine. There are some humans who live on this river, and they don't want their river to be destroyed. What are you going to do about them? He said, you pay them. I said, okay. What if they don't want to leave? He said, you pay them a lot. I said, what if they really don't want to leave? He said, you pay them even more. I said, okay, what if they've been living there for 5,000 years and their ancestors are on this land and they refuse to leave? He said, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 600. He said, well, there's 1 million people in the city, so we vote. And the people, in the million people in the city vote, and so then we remove them. I said, do you realize that you have gone in about five sentences from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire? That's how this works. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, well, I didn't actually get to talk about the depressing part of my talk. Okay, I guess what I want to say is I want to do like a two-minute version of Lewis Mumford. People know Lewis Mumford? Oh, a few people. Lewis Mumford talked about something called a technic. And a technic is a technology does not emerge out of nowhere. It emerges from a technic is the social circumstances that give rise to and then emerge from a technology. So the Talua did not create chainsaws, not because they were too stupid. Instead, they created different technologies, like, for example, salmon welcoming songs. Their social circumstances would lead to that form of technology. Our social circumstances would lead to our mindset, would lead to chainsaws. And then also, once you have a technology, it changes how you perceive the world. So I live 3 miles from a grocery store, and if I do have a car, then I can drive the grocery store, I forget something, it's no big deal. Distance doesn't matter. But if I don't have a car, then 3 miles, that's a long ways to walk to the grocery store. So a technology then changes how I perceive, you know, traveling from Crescent City to San Francisco would be a job of, I don't know how long it'd take me to walk this far. I wouldn't do it. And so it changes how we perceive the world then. And he said that technologies will fall into sort of democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic is one that emerges from and leads to democratic power structures. An authoritarian technic is one that emerges from and leads to authoritarian power structures. And it's really pretty simple. A democratic technic is one that you and your community can control. So, bows and arrows, we can make our own. On the other hand, guns, you're dependent upon mines, you're dependent on whoever makes the bullets, you're dependent upon, unless you live in a bat cave, you're dependent on, you know, gunpowder from somebody else. So it is controlled by others. So that makes it authoritarian because they can control you through it. We talked about agriculture, especially people earlier talked about agriculture, that it's authoritarian because it allows you to be controlled by others. And grocery stores are authoritarian because I'm controlled by others, as opposed to why would I go to the grocery store when there's salmon in the stream behind my home? So gathering would be a democratic technic. And passive solar, democratic technic. Solar photovoltaics, authoritarian technic. But they're authoritarian not only because they lead to authoritarian power structures, but they're authoritarian because the technology itself is authoritarian, and the technology itself ends up in charge. So once you create cars, the cars are in control. It's like I saw this cartoon years ago that was two machines talking, and one of them said, we had them from the toaster. And the point is that global warming, yeah, it was happening way before, but the burning of oil is for industry. It's primarily for industry. It's almost exclusively for industry. 5 minutes. Okay. The drought in California. You know, we always hear you should take shorter showers and all that stuff, that we have to take responsibility for the drought. Bullshit. 90% of the water used by human beings is used by agriculture and industry. So if you take shorter showers, all it's going to do is ruin your social life. Municipal golf courses use the same amount of water as municipal human beings. So the technic becomes in charge. That's how they can say it's a dilemma between fracking and drinking water, because the technology is in charge. So that's one of the ways that an authoritarian technics, I mean, we're sacrificing life on Earth rather than question the wisdom of buying into these technics. And that's one of the ways an authoritarian technics is authoritarian. Like any other despot, it cannot be questioned, even when it's killing all we hold dear. And that's what we're up against. I mean, so where does all this leave us? It leaves us the same place we started, which is the world's being killed, and we need to stop it. So I've already talked about what I think is necessary early on. Another way to think about that is to ask what Delta Smelt would do if they could take on human manifestation, and what would Coho Salmon do, and what would Redwoods do, and what would Prairies do? Another way to say all this is that so many Indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. That's also what we need to do to get over PTSD. We need to break our identification with the perpetrator. We need to break our addiction to the authoritarian techniques. We need to make our allegiance to the victims of this culture absolute. We need to make our allegiance to the land absolute. We need to make our allegiance to Coho Salmon and Pacific Lamprey absolute. Our allegiance to Port Arthur Cedar and Western Lily absolute. We need to find what we love, and then we need to defend our beloved. This identification takes many forms. There was an essay by George Monbiot right after Fukushima in which one of the things he said is that nuclear power is great because of global warming, that we all need to do nuclear power, because how else are we going to get the power that we need to run our factories? I'm going to change a couple words that's going to change everything. How are the capitalists going to get the energy that they need to run their factories? And that's the split we need to make. It's not us needing electricity to run our factories, it's them needing electricity to run their factories. Once you break that split, everything else is technical. Then we can figure out how to do it. So I need to be clear about something else. Humans are not killing the planet. Industrial humans are killing the planet. Humans identify more with this culture than they do with life or killing the planet. Humans lived on this planet for tens or hundreds of thousands of years without destroying it. It's only in the last 6,000 years that a culture toxic enough to kill the planet has emerged. The choice we face is not between killing ourselves and killing the planet. The choice we face is continuing this way of life that's killing the planet and us or not. We can allow this culture to kill the planet, or we can bring down this culture. So what do I want you to do? I don't know you, and I don't know your gifts. So instead of me telling you what to do, I want you to ask yourself, what do you love? Whatever you love, it's under assault. Dig in and defend it. And what are your gifts? And people have said to me, God, Derek, you've written so many books. Why don't you quit now and be an organizer? Oh, for God's sake, I can't even organize my fucking backpack, you know? And also, it's like, I may not seem like it here, but I am an extreme introvert. And organizers have to do this horrible, horrible, they have to, like, talk to strangers. And I think I might rather the planet be killed. It's a joke, you know, but it's like, there are things that we can do and things that we can't do. Things that we, it's like, I don't want to be a fucking lawyer. What are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you give back to the land who gave you your life? And what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? The big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't. I think those are important discussions to have, but the big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. Do something. And finally, some good news. I often think about the partisans in World War II, and I think about them doing their part to bring down the Nazis. And then I think about an advantage that they had over us. They didn't have to defeat the Nazis by themselves. They had the Allies. For the longest time, this depressed the hell out of me. Where is a big Soviet army rumbling in? And where are the British and U.S. bombers to destroy the Nazi war machines? There isn't one. But then I realized that I have been wrong all along. There is something much bigger than the Allies that will help us, and that's the real world. Life desperately wants to live. And from the smallest root reaching into the biggest dam to the wildest hurricane and fastest tornado, who are doing what they can, to the leaf-scaled sea snakes and three-toed pygmy sloths and the Sumatran rhinos and the Cayman Islands ghost orchids, who are desperately trying to hang on until the non-human and human resistance kicks in to end this nightmare that's gone on for too long. The whole world is resisting. We have them on our side. So we don't have to do it by ourselves. We just have to join them. And we have to use our gifts and use your gifts, whatever they are, in the service of that greater good. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you so much for coming, and I think somebody, I think Dylan here is going to talk about important things.
Thanks, Derek. Can we just show us some gratitude for our incredible panelists and speakers today and give them a round of applause? I was asked to close the day today, and I was pretty excited about that at first, and then I heard what was going on today. I heard what was being spoken about, and I'm just, I don't know how I can follow that. But my name is Dylan Thompson. I am a board member of Fertile Ground Environmental Institute and one of the core organizers of this event. Just a couple housekeeping things real quick. One of our Indigenous guests has asked that all Indigenous people stay for a few minutes afterwards to connect. And it's going to happen in the far corner of the lobby after this. And then also, we're going to need to be out of here, not by 6, but before 6. So we're going to need to make an exodus out of here pretty rapidly after this. Thanks for being here. Thank you so much for being here. It really warms my heart that you've stuck it out all day today. It's been a long day. So I'm going to make it short and sweet here. But I wanted to talk about something, you know, when I knew that the words today were going to be hard to follow. So I just want to keep it simple and talk about something basic. And I want to talk about decay, something that I feel is pretty basic. And that's kind of what this conference is about. It's kind of about getting back to basics. It's kind of about shaking things up. It's about shaking up the discourse that seems to have been so infected by this culture, so infected by capitalism, patriarchy, individualism. There are times when we need to shake things up and remember what it is we are doing, why it is we are fighting. Part of the reason we started Fertile Ground Environmental Institute in 2008 was because of this belief that we needed to go back to basics. And that doesn't mean oversimplifying the problems we face, because they're not simple. They're going to take some work, and they're going to take a lot of complicated work. But what I want to talk about right now, and just say a couple words about, is remembering the elemental framework within which we wage our struggles. And I'm basically talking about the elemental framework of ecology. Derek spoke about our collective stupor at forgetting that the world gets to be so diverse and fecund by beings living and dying, and just doing the things that they do. But we live in a culture that only knows living and only knows growing. And you can definitely argue that it doesn't even know living. It only really knows death. And so it's been running for the past 10 to 12,000 years away from that responsibility to the rest of nature, to that elemental truth of ecology, to decay. It is not going to decay. It is not interested in being held accountable to black rhinos, hawksbill turtles, or marbled murrelets, or finless porpoises, or rainforests, or mountains, or rivers, or humans at the end of the day. All I want to say is that we as ecologists, we as humans who care about these issues, cannot be afraid of decay. We cannot adopt this cultural fear of decay any longer. We have to see decay as beautiful and as a force of justice. Because this culture has gone on for far too long, and it has taken way, 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 way too much with it. And given what this culture has perpetrated, there is not a lot in this world that is as beautiful to me as this culture's decay. And it is the food that nourishes the growth of something inside me which is undeniably alive, the living, breathing faith in the land. And so that's kind of all I really wanted to impart to you before you all leave, is just to remember ecology and to remember what we're trying to do. We have a lot of work going on, and a lot of people focusing actually on growth and making sure that there's something healthy being planted in the soil, in cultural soil, in the social soil, and in the actual soil. restorationists, and we need that work. But we also need this culture to die. We need it to decay as fast as possible. And I want to just leave you with a quote, and it's just a line from Walt Whitman. It's just one of my favorite lines of poetry, and it's, "Can your performance face the open fields and the seaside? Can your performance face the open fields and the seaside?" This culture can't face up to much. It can't face anything natural and beautiful in this world, but I know that we can if we work together. Thank you so much for coming. I hope that you come back tomorrow. We have a great lineup for you, including Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, Alice Walker. It's going to be a good one. Thank you so much again for coming.